the 1993rd Annual Summer Institute for Priests at Seton Hall University presents Father John Powell on the general topic, Changing the Attitudes That Shape Our Lives.
Professor of Theology at Loyola University in Chicago. He's been awarded academic degrees in the classics, English, philosophy, psychology, and theology. His doctorate degree in theology was conferred upon him by the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome. He has published 15 books on theological and psychological themes, the most recent of which are Happiness is an Inside Job and Through Seasons of the Heart. His accomplishments have been recognized nationally with many, many awards, most recently by Assumption College in Worcester, Mass., and my own personal favorite, Marquette University, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in the form of honorary doctorate degrees. He's been active in the pro-life movement. In 1976, he took a year's leave of absence from all his other activities and responsibilities to work exclusively for the pro-life movement. Respect for every human life, born and unborn, is the most crucial issue of our time, the ultimate test of our humanness and of our recognition of the sovereignty of God. In 1980, he was invited to host a weekly half-hour television program called The American Catholic with Father John Powell, S.J. This program reached an estimated 9 million homes each week. It was the first national Catholic program since the series produced by the late Bishop Fulton J. Sheen. That program now continues under the same title on radio throughout the country. All of John Powell's publications, including books, audio, visual, and video cassette, are published by Argus Communications, Tabor Publishing, Allen, Texas. It can be obtained through them. It is my pleasure to give you Father John Powell.
First thing I have to tell you is what I suffer from, and it's called an imposter's complex, where you get more honor than you think you deserve, and you feel like a klutz that everybody tells you you're a hero. I read a book some years ago called The Imposter Complex, and it was the lady who wrote the book said that it ranks highest among psychiatrists and secondly among the clergy. And I've often thought that it's really hard to live with yourself after you give a good sermon. I always want to say, I was giving a sermon on death one time, and I said, oh, what do we have to fear if we really believe? I mean, death is not the end, it's just the beginning. And I was going on with, what do we have to worry about? And I got a pain in the center of my chest. And oh my God, this could be a heart attack. But afterwards, I thought, that's funny, my stomach and my mouth are 16 inches apart and they're not connected. And more recently I was in New Zealand giving a series of talks, and they have chemical smelters over there that give off a smoky, acrid odor. And so I was, my topic was, and it will grab you around the aorta, I'm sure, worry is a mild form of atheism. Worry is like being in a rocking chair. It doesn't get you anywhere, but it gives you something to do. So I was telling them about the lilies of the field and the birds of the air. And then because my father was Irish and my mother was Italian, I tend to be dramatic. And I'm acting out scenes from the Gospels. And I have Martha come out of the kitchen saying, Jesus! She's talking to him, of course. And she said, tell Mary to give me a hand with the dinner out in the kitchen. And Jesus said, Mary said, oh, Martha, honey, you get all worked up about so many little things. One thing is necessary, and Mary has chosen the better part. I've often wondered how Martha felt when he said that. Yeah, sure, she's chosen the better part. It's cooler out here than it is in that kitchen. And I always want to ask Jesus when I get to heaven, and I'm sure I'm in. If you'd wanted something done in a hurry, which one of the two girls would you have called on? I bet it wasn't Mary. But the last scene I was acting out there in New Zealand for the Kiwis was Jesus, after he's preaching and teaching all day, is asleep in the bottom of a boat, and the apostles are rowing across the Sea of Galilee, and they know this sea like our mother's kitchens, you know? And the boat starts to rock, and then a wave hits one of them in the face. He says, "Oh, my God, it's a squall. We had a squall." And they wake up the Lord. They say, "Master, Master, wake up. Don't they concern you? We could be drowning." And then they're in New Zealand. I'm Jesus. And I wipe the sleep out of my eye. Boom! The Sea of Galilee becomes a plate of glass. And the Lord turns to those apostles, and he asks them the question he's always asking you and me. "Why were you worried? Didn't you know that I was with you?" And just as I say that, I smell smoke. So look, remember my topic is worryism, my old form of atheism. I start to get this worried look on my face. I said, I smell smoke. Do you smell smoke?" And these people were saying, "He's part of the dramatization. He's just joking, you know, he's not really worried." They're all laughing. And I'm saying, "No, I smell smoke. Do you smell smoke?" And finally someone near the front said, "Those are the chemical smelters. They give us that odor." So I became suave and deboner again. And I said, "Oh." And some guy in the back said, "Why were you worried? Do you know I was with you?" Right on. So anyway, I do feel like Bob Newhart. He told this story about his sister, who's a BVM nun, and her mother house is Dubuque, Iowa. And so Bob went up to visit his sister, the nun, and he got a room at the Dubuque Hotel, and the waiter came down and said, "You'll start with potato soup, right?" And Bob said, "No, I don't like potato soup." He said, "Oh, sir." He said, come. He said, "You know, that's our specialty here. You know that?" And Bob said, "Well, I really don't want any potato soup. Thank you." He said, "Sir, do you know you're the first patron I've ever waited on that didn't begin with potato soup?" And Bob said, "Well, I don't like potato soup, so can we go on with the menu?" So they did, and the waiter was belligerent after that. But he wouldn't start with the specialty of the house. So he paid his bill, went up to his room, and the man in the room next to him had diverticulitis, and he needed a daily enema. And he forgot his portable enema at home, so his wife called the paramedics of Dubuque and said, "Could you go up to my husband's room and give him an enema?" They said, "Sure." And so she gave him the room number, and she said, "Now listen, he may try to say no, but don't take no for an answer. You give him the enema." And they said, "Right on, lady." So, of course, they went up to Bob Newhart's room, and they wrestled him down on the bed, and they gave him an enema. So he's visiting his sister, the nun, the next day. And she said, "How are things over at the Dubuque Hotel?" And he said, "Well, it's a nice hotel." But he said, "Just in case you have visitors again, warn them to take the potato soup the first time they offer it. Because they're going to give it to you one way or another." I am reminded of the first time, I feel like I was the wrong man all the time, but the first time I ever talked to priests was at a priest retreat at Mundelein, Illinois, at the priest retreat house, and I was about 35 years old, I guess, at the time, and there was a Monsignor Mohan who ran the retreat house. I was standing outside the chapel watching the retreatants file in, and I thought, "I'm going to be the youngest man here." And I was terrified. You know, it's really hard to speak to people who have the same basic, same education you do. And they were all parading in with their big Milwaukee tumors. And they had red cummerbunds around the waist. They looked to the side like this. So I said, "Oh!" And Monsignor Mohan said, "How do you feel?" And I said, "Terrified." He said, "Why?" And I said, "You see those birds that just walked in here?" And he put his arm around me and he said, "Oh, they just need what everybody else needs, a little love and a little understanding." And I thought to myself, "Ooh, they don't look like they need love and understanding to me." And I said, "Do you see them?" And so I got up in front of the audience And no one smiled at my joke. I don't know what joke I used, but I was supposed to tell him a little joke at the beginning to render him benevolent. No one laughed. And the only time anyone smiled at all during that whole first talk was when one of them fell asleep. And he was snoring, big Z's, you know, like a dive bomber. And no one waked him up. And they thought that was really funny, that old Hank fell asleep. And I thought to myself when I was leaving, oh, God, I'm going to preach to these guys for a week. This is awful. And I was walking out and thought, I should have volunteered for the foreign missions. You know, I should have done something. And other than give this retreat. I went to my room and the chimes came out of the clothes closet. I said, oh, my God, I'm hearing things now. And then I opened the door, and there was a chair and a grill and a stall. I said, oh, it's a confessional. I wonder who's coming to confession. It was one of the priests. And I think three of the first five priests in the course of their confession cried. And I remember thinking, hey, were you out in the audience tonight? I didn't see any tear ducts out there. Oh, my goodness. I thought it was one of the nuns that was coming to confession. But then an old man came in, and he had been arrested. And he was arrested in a men's room, I guess for a public display or something. Like, he didn't zip up his pants in time. And he was taken to the police station. You remember, he had white hair, and he wasn't from the Chicago Archdiocese, I recall. And I'm trusting that he's in heaven by now. But he said, they took him down to the police station. They asked him to produce identification. And the desk sergeant yelled, this weirdo is a priest. And he shoved my identification back at me and said, just get out of here. And don't you ever preach to me again from your lousy little pulpit. And don't think I'll send my kids to Catholic schools anymore either. And he said, everybody was looking. Everybody stopped in the police station to watch me. And he said, I got outside and I thought I better walk. I better take a long walk. And exhaust myself so I can sleep tonight. But he said, the more I walked, the more the darkness of the night got inside my soul. And he said, if they had beaten me up physically, I think I could have taken that better than the humiliation. And I kept thinking, wow, I hope when I'm only half your age, but I hope when I'm your age, I have half your humility. I thought that was great. And the poor fellow, he said that the desk sergeant told his bishop. The bishop told him he had to undergo psychotherapy, and he did. He was undergoing psychotherapy at the time, but he was a bitter old man. But he was truthful, and he was honest, and he was open. And I thought, oh, wow. So I thought, I better take the pulse again of priests. I left the first conference thinking, I'll never do this again. This is awful. And then I thought, after I got to know them, that they're really fine men. They're really beautiful fellows. And so I think I've given a priest retreat every year since then. But because I really enjoy what I was once feared, talking to priests. What we're going to talk about in the 2.5 days that I will be talking to you is on attitudes. How did I get there? How did I get to attitudes? They're the most important thing. When I was in the seminary, I was sure of this, that you got to make your life an act of love. Now, I once said this at a wedding, and I got flack from about 25 people who said, you can't love everybody. And I said, well, it depends on how you define love. But you got to love yourself, you got to love other people, and you got to love God. And you got to balance those three and somehow integrate them, find out how each of them relates to the others. I remember one time I was on a speaking tour in Australia, and a woman came out of the wings of the stage. She just met me right outside, and the audience was still clapping. I think it was at Monash University. And she said, hey, Yank, I just want you to know the one eligible all of us out there what disagree with every word you're saying. Well, think about that, Yank. And she blew smoke in my face. She had a little liquor on her breath, but she wasn't drunk. And I said, let me translate what you just said. Did you say there are a hell of a lot of people out there who disagree with every word I'm saying? She says, well, I said, Yank, well, think about that, huh? I said, I'll tell you what I think about that. I think you're out to hurt me. I don't think you want to help me. I think you want to hurt me if it's true. If that's what you want to do, just to hurt me, I don't need that, and I don't need you. And I think that was a loving thing to do. I think that was loving of myself. And I've got to love myself. You can't, the rhetoric of religious life and the priesthood having a heart of bronze for chastity and a heart of a will of steel and give without counting the cost, to bleed without heeding the wounds and all, beautiful rhetoric, but it doesn't apply to us, does it? It doesn't apply to human beings. And sometimes I think we're goaded into kind of a perfectionistic attitude. But at any rate, you gotta love yourself and you gotta love other people. You gotta really care about people. And you gotta balance their needs against yours. And you gotta love God by doing His will and by really caring about the interests of God in this world. But at any rate, I was sure of that, that you had to make your life an act of love. And when I got out as a priest, I saw that love has a poor track record. That one out of two marriages ends in divorce, and 65% of all second marriages end in divorce. I mean, why doesn't love work? And then I got into communication. And I felt strongly about this because I don't think my mom and dad ever communicated. I don't think they ever knew each other. I think if they lie under the same headstone in the same cemetery now. But I've often thought that if an angel ever inscribed on their tombstone an epitaph which was suitable to their life together, it would be, "Here lie two good and decent people who never knew each other." And I began to think that, and maybe I'm wrong about it, but I submit that to you anyway, that most people don't really know one another. As a university teacher, I perform a lot of marriages, and when the bride comes up the aisle and the groom meets her, I always ask myself, I wonder how well they know each other. And my answer is probably not very well. How well did you know yourself when you were 22, 23 years old? But at least they're deciding that they're going to make it together. They're going to grow up together. They're going to get in the same boat and try this uncharted journey. But anyway, I really began to understand that it's communication that is the lifeblood of love. That you got to tell someone else who you are. And the one thing you want to stay away from is manipulation. If I tell you who I am in order to get you to feel sorry for me or to make you feel responsible for me, take care of me, then that's manipulation. I just want to share myself with you because it's the only gift I have worth giving. And I want you to have it because I love you. I care about you. But what you do with what I say, that's up to you, of course. And I do not want you to solve my problems. I do not want you to feel sorry for me. I do not want you to feel responsible. Just to share what I have to say. That's communication. Anyway, I felt very strongly about that and got into the marriage encounter movement. Made that marriage encounter with another priest. The first thing they gave us, at least on our marriage encounter, was, "How do you feel about this?" And my priest friend was an alcoholic, and I didn't know that, an active alcoholic. And he said, "I'm really glad to make this encounter with you so I can talk to you. I can unload all this on you." And I wrote down, "I'm really glad to make this because I don't have to perform for anybody. I don't have to listen to anybody, which I do all the time." And we just exchange notebooks. That's what you do at the marriage encounter. You write for 10 minutes, then you exchange, and we just laughed at each other. He was anxious to tell me all about his alcoholism, and I was anxious to be a non-performer, a non-listener. At any rate, then I was giving a day to married couples in Grand Rapids, Michigan. They always pick a celibate to tell people how to be happily married, you know? And so I was telling these married couples, you got to communicate. And the essence of communication is sharing your feelings. Now get in touch with what you're feeling. And share it with each other. So I got a letter when I got home back to Loyola from some woman who made it, and she said, "Hey, wise guy, you told us to spill our guts." Well, we did. And my husband just told me that he's never been unhappier than the 12 years we've been married. He's been discouraged, he's been lonely, he's been sad. What do we do now? And I go, "Oh, what do you do now?" "I don't know." So I wrote back and I said, "Well, it's better than it's out, isn't it? I mean, you talk about it anyway." But I really didn't understand, where do negative emotions come from? And that's how I get into attitudes. That negative emotions come from attitudes. They say they had a seminar at Loyola in Chicago where I teach on what an emotion is. And they said at the heart of every emotion is a perception. You always perceive something a certain way, and that causes the physical redundancy. You got to have a body to have emotion. That causes the physical redundancy that is an emotion. And it's right there at that center of every emotion, that perception, that is very important. If I perceive you as a friendly audience, I feel very comfortable talking to you. But if I were to perceive you as a hostile audience with guns across your lap, come on, Jesuit boy, send up a trial balloon, we'll shoot out of the sky, that would be a different story, wouldn't it? But I think this is true. That at the heart of every emotion is a perception, and that's what we can change, and that's what an attitude is. It's a way of perceiving something. And so what I'm convinced of now, in the title of my last book, Happiness is an Inside Job, is that happiness is a matter of attitudes. It has to come from within. I saw a cartoon recently where a big woman is standing over a little henpecked husband, and she's saying, "Make me happy." And it's a cartoon because no one can make you happy. No one can make you unhappy. I can't cause an emotion in you. I can only stimulate what's already in you. And if your attitudes are healthy, then you're healthy. Then you're happy. If your attitudes are unhealthy, then you're unhappy. They say, for example, we'll talk more about this in the second talk, about that the central attitude, the most important of all those attitudes up in your mind, you have thousands of them up there, little drawers of the mind, the most important one is the attitude you have toward yourself. And this is difficult to get at. What do you think about yourself? How do you feel about yourself? That's difficult to get at, but it is the most important of all the attitudes that you have. But anyway, Epictetus, one of the old philosophers at the time of Jesus, used to go around saying, "It's not your problems that are bothering you. Really, it isn't. You know what it is? It's the way you look at them. It's the way you perceive them. It's your attitude. Your attitude toward problems." I remember one time driving a car down Eden's Expressway in Chicago, and the car died. And unfortunately, I don't know anything about cars except their color, and I don't. Not sure of all of them. And the car died, and I got over to the side of the road, and I looked down, and there was a big grassy slope there with a fence at the bottom, and I thought, ooh, I'm not going down in that grass. There could be snakes. And I tear my pants crawling over that lousy fence. And I looked out the other direction. There were six lanes of whizzing traffic, and I thought, I'm not going to play in the traffic. My mother didn't raise dummies, you know. So I thought, what'll I do? And I really didn't know what to do. That was what bothered me, that I didn't know what to do. And I thought, do they drop care packages from the sky for stranded motorists? I didn't know. You know, I thought of that song about the Massachusetts Transit Authority, but poor Charlie didn't have a nickel to get off, so did he ever return? No, he never returned. And his fate is still unlearned. And I thought, they're going to find my bones here at Eden's and Dempster. So I've often thought about people who lean on others all the time in life as hitchhikers. I secretly call them hitchhikers. You know, when they go out to dinner with them, they say, "What do you think I should order, huh? What do you think I should do, huh?" And so I decided to become a hitchhiker, and I didn't have my Roman collar on. I had a lousy old sports shirt on. You know, me and my RC, we can do almost anything. So I got out to the edge of Eden's Expressway, and I developed a constipated look. The cars were whizzing by me, and I said, "Oh, these heartless people. And see, I'm in trouble." And finally a boy stopped, and he opened a Volkswagen door, and he said, "Can I help you?" And I jumped in, put the seatbelt on, and then said, "Yes." And he said, "You're a little tense, aren't you?" And I said, "What was your first clue?" And he said, I said, "That car back there, that's my car. That's the car I was driving." And he said, "Oh." So I imagine that is a rather tense experience to have a car die under you on an expressway. And I said, "No, it wasn't that." And it really wasn't that. And it was only later that I found out it was the attitude I have when I don't know what to do. It really bothers me. If they had put instructions in the glove compartment of every Buick Century, if your car dies at Edens and Dempster, you do the following, I'd fine. No problem. But they didn't. Well, anyway, a girl who typed for me came in, and she weighs about 110 pounds. She's carrying two shopping bags. And she said, "I'm sorry I'm late, but my car died." And I said, "Where?" She said, "At Edens and Dempster." I thought of the Bermuda Triangle. I said, "Which way were you going?" She said, "I was going south on Dempster." And I said, "That's where I was going. What did you do?" "Well, I pulled the car over the side of the road." And I said, "Yeah? And then what?" "Well, I climbed down that hill." I said, "You went down that hill?" And she said, "Yes." And she's winning the Ultra Bright Grin contest when she's telling me this. And I said, "You really went down that hill? Wasn't there a fence at the bottom?" She said, "I know, but I climbed over it." And, you know, right on, rah-rah, over the top girls, you know? And I said, "Could I ask you a personal question? How did you feel when you were doing this?" And so help me God, she said, "Exhilarated!" And so help me God, I said, "Oh, I hate you." But what I realized is that two people can have the same, exact same experience, and one finds it catastrophic, as I did, and one finds it a real challenge to be creative. It all depends on your attitude, up there in the head. And I'm sure that when John the Baptist called yesterday for a metanoia, a new way of looking at things, he was trying to get at the conversion center, I think, in everybody, which is the mind. It's the attitude you have. What do you think about this? How do you perceive this? And when Jesus is talking in the 8th chapter of John's Gospel to his contemporaries, and they say, "Hey, we're free men, you know, we're Jews, we're the slaves of no one." He's, "Oh, no, you're not free. If you were free, you'd be rid of all those demons inside you. The guilt, the loneliness, the sadness, the crippling attitudes. But oh, if you set me in my message, oh, then you'll really be free, because if the Son of Man sets you free, you're really free." And I think about that, and I think, yeah, he was talking about the Beatitudes. You want to be happy? Then you got to have the right attitudes, the happiness-making attitudes, the Beatitudes. Now down through the centuries, what everybody says is the same. John Milton, the blind poet, once said, the human mind can make of life a heaven or a hell. And everybody's mind does that, depending on your attitudes. Ray Charles, as you know, is a black blind pianist, and I have a disease of the eyes I'll tell you about later, that I'm supposed to go blind. I was supposed to go blind, I think, before this. But I was listening to Ray Charles being interviewed one time, and the interviewer asked him, "Is it true that if God offered you back your sight, you wouldn't take it?" And he said, "No, that's true." And the interviewer said, I really don't understand that. How could you say you wouldn't want your sight back?" And he said, "Well, when you're blind, you know, you really get to know people. When my little children crawl up in my lap," and I think his children were small at the time, he said, "all I feel are their little arms around my neck, and I feel their little body in my lap. But if I could see them, I would probably say, 'You have dirt on your shoes. Go wash your hands.'" But he said, "Some beautiful people are not packaged very beautifully, but you don't see them." So he said, "There's a real advantage in being blind." And I thought to myself, oh, it all depends on your attitude, doesn't it? Some people really turn bitter. The disease I have of the eyes is called retinitis pigmentosa. And I go down once a year to talk to the Retinitis Pigmentosa Foundation in Chicago, where they have dinners. And some of the people are really bitter about losing their sight. And other people, one blind man stood up and said, what can you do that I haven't done? Parachute out of airplane, I've done that, you know, and so forth. He does all this blind. And I said, all depends on your attitude, doesn't it? So I finally got to attitudes. And I'd like to begin by suggesting to you, the way you think is the way you feel. It really is. The way you think determines the way you feel. Describes your emotional patterns. It also, the way you think, the attitudes that are in you describe the use of abilities. It really is. The way you think determines the way you feel. Describes your emotional patterns. It also, the way you think, the attitudes that are in you describe the use of abilities. You know, they say that the average person uses only, in the course of life, uses only 10% of his or her abilities. 10%! And what happens the other 90%? Well, it goes down some futile drain because it's paralyzed by fear. A priest friend of mine said he's walking behind a little boy and his mother, and they passed a popcorn machine. You could see the popcorn in the big glass bowl, and the little boy tugged at his mother's sleeve. And she got out the right coins, and then they went over to the machine, and the little boy couldn't read, so she read to him, "Out of order." And she said, try and explain to him that you can see that popcorn, but it can't come out. Because somewhere, somehow, deep down inside that machine, something got hurt. And the popcorn can't come out. And the little boy started to cry, and they walked away. And the priest said, "And I want to cry too, Lord. I want to cry for all those people in whom there is so much goodness that could come out but can't, because somewhere deep down inside that person, something got hurt. Something got paralyzed by fear. Something painted that corner into that person into a small corner of life." More recently, William James, who was an anatomist and physiologist trained at Harvard and started to practice medicine, he discovered what I think most doctors would say. Every doctor I know has said it, that 92% of all people who come in with physical illness is traceable to a psychological origin. The disease is psychologically induced. And one thing we do know, everybody knows, is that when you get, your emotions get in turmoil, the immune system shuts down. And everybody, they say, for example, has had, I don't know if it's true or not, but a Dr. Simonton in Fort Worth, Texas says this, that everybody has had cancer. There are cancer cells in everybody, but they're weak cells. And if your immune system is good, it kills off those weak cells. When they try to transplant skin cancers in people who are healthy and who love life, they never take. But in prisoners, state prisons, and people who have a life that doesn't hold out anything to them, then it does take. Well, William James, anyway, discovered that all the people who come into him, as most doctors think this is psychological. But they treat the physical symptoms anyway, take two aspirins and call me in the morning. And William James became a psychiatrist. And he wrote two big, you probably know him from his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, but he wrote two big fat volumes called The History of Psychology. And they're still used in some medical schools. And one of the lines he wrote was this: the most important thing about any person are his or her attitudes. That if you change one attitude of the mind, you change all the outer aspects of life. You change the emotional patterns. You change the ability to relate to people. You change the use of ability. You change everything about that person if you can change one attitude of the mind. He said that's the most amazing discovery of our generation. And just recently, a psychiatrist named David Burns at the University of Pennsylvania, who works in the depression clinic there, and the World Health Organization has said that depression is the most prevalent sickness among all human beings throughout the world. Depression, sadness. Clinical depression is when there's something wrong inside the person, and the mind and everything else just shuts down. People who are depressed don't feel anything. They don't feel any desires, nothing. David Burns says there's some error in the way the person's thinking. There's some crippling attitude inside that person. and he divides his book into the 10 ways of thinking in a way that will produce depression. And he claims, David Burns, the psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania, claims that this is far more effective than medication. You know, doctors give out Elavil and various antidepressant drugs, and they do work, but they sometimes hide the real problem. And the real problem is probably in the thinking. Now, how do you know, presuming that you have thousands of attitudes up in your brain, where did you get them? Mostly from your parents. Parents act out certain things in front of us. They don't sit us down and give us lectures, but they act out certain things in front of us, and then you know that's important. I came from a poor family where the discussion was always centered around money. Do we have enough money for this? Can we do this? And money has always been important to me, even though I have a vow of poverty as a Jesuit, you know? Money has always seemed important because Mom and Dad always talked about it. It was always the big issue at home. Can we afford a new refrigerator? Can we do this? Can we afford it? And so in a way, your parents did too. My father told me, for example, that a man is never afraid of anything. Don't ever be afraid. And so I denied until I was 40 years old that I was ever afraid. I was popping a lot of Tums and Rolaids and things like that because my stomach didn't know what my mouth knew. But I knew I was never afraid until I was 40. And so you got a similar set of attitudes. I don't know what they are. But you got them from your parents and they took them to school with you and you modified them a little bit by your own experience. But in general, the older I get, the more I realize that I'm kind of a carbon copy of my parents' attitudes. And that's what we're going to talk about, and especially about the attitude toward the priesthood. What do I think of when I think of the priesthood? What do I think it is? What is this thing that I share with Jesus, the priesthood of Christ, the mediatorial ability of Christ? I see that it's 9:51, and we're supposed to have some questions and answers before 10 o'clock and then a break. So if you'd like to ask questions, please use the microphone in the center aisle, and I'll be glad to try. And if you have any statements or objections or anything like that, the floor is yours. It's always the first one that's the hardest, I know. No questions? Oh, here we go. Good man.
Father, in being a carbon copy of our parents, when you said that, it came the end of your talk, and of course I'm sure you're going to throw more light on this. We have these attitudes from our parents. We are copies of our parents. Okay. Now, the point is, how deep-seated are they? Because we were most vulnerable at that time. And is it possible to change those attitudes? And at what age in our lifetime are we best able to change those attitudes? Because, of course, most of us here are like 39 or 40. And like myself, I'm 39, but I mean, I'm concerned about that 39. Can we change? I think that's the important thing.
Good question. First of all, I want to say, because I originally said carbon copies, you know, the attitudes that affected you were not what your parents said to you, but what you heard. You heard them say, and you know, they speak about the semantic problem. When I say you're sweet and you're sweet, two different people hear two different things. And one says, oh, thank you. The other one says, don't call me sweet. Because they heard two different things. And every child hears the parents a different way. That's amazing to me. I was once saying Mass for a group of family, and I passed by this little boy because he hadn't received his first communion yet. And he had his lower lip out at the end of Mass. And I said, Matt, is there something wrong? No. And he burst out into tears. He told me that he thought I passed him by because I didn't like him. And I said, oh, Matt, I'm really glad that came out because you're one of the finest boys I know. You really are. You're really a great kid. And then everything was all right again. But at any rate, everybody receives the message of parents differently. Like, I've often thought that the people who came from Europe, the immigrants, you know, were probably the bravest people in all Europe. But their children grew up seeing them huddled together. They didn't speak the language. They spoke with an accent. And they were kind of ashamed of them. And they were the bravest people of all. But the message of bravery didn't come through. The message of daring didn't come through. But I once asked a girl from Cuba if her parents spoke English. She said, speak English. And she was kind of ashamed of them for speaking spick English. But at any rate, I think that's true. That you're not exactly a carbon copy, but you are what you heard. It is true also that the first years of life are the most impressionable. And in the first years of life, we're all helpless. And someone who counts messages said that the average child gets 431 negative messages every day between birth and age 5. I don't know how they get that number, but that's what someone said. 431. And I just recently, about 2 or 3 months ago, I was speaking in a church in the area of Chicago, and a little girl, 3 years old, was asleep on her father's shoulder, and I was trying to explicitate some of these messages that children get, like, get down from there, you'll hurt yourself. You're too small. No, don't bake a cake. You'll make another mess. That's not the way you tie shoes. Oh, you got dirt all over yourself. You spilled your milk. Now be quiet. I've had a hard day. And the little girl looked up at me and then looked back at her father and said, Daddy, why is he speaking about me? Every child knows that this is the kind of thing that you say to children. And we all know, too, that the first message you get in life when you are helpless, are the ones that last. And so Adler's whole psychology is built on the fact that everybody has an inferiority complex. Everybody I know that is known intimately does have an inferiority complex. I certainly do. I think everybody does. Everybody's insecure. But can you change them? And the answer is, oh yes, you can. But, I think the Alcoholics Anonymous movement, from which I'm not an alcoholic, I'm still completing my qualifications. But I have learned more from the AA movement. I think it's divinely inspired. I really do. I think God was in Bill Wilson and Bob Moore when they founded Alcoholics Anonymous. But at any rate, one of the latest movements is the ACOA movement, the Adult Children of Alcoholics. And I had two girls in class who were like zombies. You know, they had the Mona Lisa look permanently plastered on their face. And when they came in to talk to me, they both said they were adult children of alcoholics. And I said, who drank in your family? And it's my dad. Both of them, it was the father. Does he still drink? No, he stopped when I was an adolescent. And I said, well, it still affects you. Oh, yeah. They said, because these messages, see, we have tape recorders up in our heads. And these messages get recorded on those tape recorders. Don't talk. Don't make waves. Don't get close to anybody. Daddy will throw a tantrum if you do. And so you act accordingly, and then that gets to be habitual. Now, can you change? I started to say, and I will talk more about this, that fortunately, every crippling attitude will show up in the form of pain. There will be some kind of discomfort in your life. And then if you're willing to become an owner and not a blamer, and you say, what's in me that causes this discomfort? You'll get to the attitude. You'll psychoanalyze yourself, and you'll find out what the attitude is. So that pain may be physical. If you always get a headache at certain times, whenever I go into theology class, I get a headache. Well, there's something wrong about theology class. I had a boy in class, by the way, this is very interesting, who was, I thought he was hyperactive. And I put my hand over his, and finally the other kids in the class said, if that kid comes to class, I'm walking out. So I talked to this boy, and I said, hey, it's not my idea. The other student's starting to complain, and he was stricken by this. But I gave him the course tutorially. We finished the course privately, so he didn't have to come to class because he was such a disturbance. And he really was a big disturbance, you know, but I didn't think he could control himself. And one girl said, he's not hyperactive. She said, I'm hyperactive, and I know what hyperactivity is like. Something else, he's trying to get somebody's attention, maybe trying to bother you. Because I watch him in the library and he's not like that. He can sit for hours just reading a book. And so later on, the boy came in and I asked him about that. And he goes to he's been on drugs and he goes to a psychotherapist. And the psychotherapist said, I think it was something about theology class that was bothering you. I don't think it was your hyperactivity you had as a child. I think what your teacher was saying was bothering you. And he said, and I think that now too. It's what you were saying that was really bothering me. So I think all crippling activities will show up in the form of some kind of discomfort. It might be physical discomfort. It might be a headache. It might be emotional discomfort. It might be sadness. It might be guilt feelings or something. But some attitude that is crippling will show up in you in the form of discomfort. I just want to tell you, in conclusion, that Paul Brand was a medical doctor, worked with lepers. And he said, oh, thank God for your ability to feel pain. Because he said, when you see pictures of lepers without noses and without fingers, he said, it isn't the Hansen's disease that does this. It's not the leprosy. It's the fact that they have no pain. They have no sensation. So they twist a key in a lock, a stubborn lock, and they gash their flesh and infection sits in, and the fingers drop off. They don't know that. So the fingers drop off because they have no sensation. But the same thing, they scratch their nose, infection sits in, the nose drops off. But they don't know that. So thank God for pain, because pain will lead you to the truth of who you really are. And I think this, that yes, you can change one, but you've got to know what the attitude is that is crippling. You've got to say, I am a perfectionist and I've got to stop that. I've got to start trying to enjoy life instead of trying to do my very best and expecting everybody to do their very best. And then I'll suggest ways later on in which we can change. But I think what was said was true. The older you are, the harder it gets to change. Because you've been practicing the wrong attitude for so many years, and now you've got to start learning, unlearning the old attitude and relearning a new attitude to replace it. We'll talk more about this in the future talks. Thank you very much for listening.